Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to the 25th episode of The Leading Tone podcast. We are so excited to present part two of our season one finale.
And to celebrate the final episode of this season, we'll be talking about more composers than we ever have. A whopping 27 composers from the classical period all the way to celebrated modern composers.
For those of you who have followed the series from the beginning, you know this list is a combination of both of our favorite composers. What's different today, however, is that some of these composers come from towards the top of our own personal list, but were left off the other co-hosts entirely.
This gives this finale of season one all the more meaning. We are striving to expose you, the audience, to music that we are personally passionate about. Let's go ahead and get into it, shall we?
Let's. We'll start in the classical period. A bit of review from our previous episode. In the scope of music history, the classical period of music is shorter in length, and it's really only due to the fact that it brought on so many advancements in form, structure, and harmony. It was destined to evolve sooner than perhaps Baroque music that came before. That brings us to our only classical composer on today's list, number 83 on our top 100 composers list, C.P.E. Bach. He is a German composer who lived from 1714 to 1788, and C.P.E. Bach's music embodies these characteristics of form, structure, and harmony perfectly. He is the fifth child of J.S. Bach from the Baroque period, and C.P.E. Bach is known for his keyboard works, concerti, chamber music, and some great classical symphonies. Speaking of which, today we'll listen to C.P.E. Bach's Symphony in E Minor for strings, which is a great example of the classical symphonic style. Let's take a listen.
That was C.P.E. Bach's Symphony in E Minor for Strings, a great example of the symphonic style of the classical period.
Next, we have the Romantic period, and to once again review from our previous episode, the music of this time borrowed a lot from the classical period, particularly at first. You'd hear a lot of the elements that C.P.E. Bach brought to the table in some of these composers' music. It developed a lot over the course of the 19th century, bringing us more programmatic music, unlike that of the classical period, stuff that had subject matter that was a little bit more spiritual, autobiographical, nationalistic. If you were to compare romantic music with that of what came before classical and Baroque music, you'd actually find a lot of comparisons with the early and middle Baroque styles of music. The expressive quality from these Baroque ideals is taken to previously unheard of places. This extends even more to instrumental music, having a renaissance of orchestration and instrumentation. The first romantic composer we'll discuss is number 99 on our list, just made it on, Carl Maria von Weber. And he is another German composer, Born in 1786, passed away in 1826. He was among the first of the great German Romantic composers. He's primarily known for his operatic output, but had some limited output in other genres. He has two symphonies as well as some piano works. Today, we'll be listening to his Grand Duo Concertante for clarinet and piano. This will be a really great example of some Romantic chamber music. So let's go ahead and take a listen.
That was von Weber's Grand Duo Concertante, a great example of the early Romantic style, and that's because it really breaks away from some of the structure and rigidity of the classical period. The Romantic period is just starting to bud at this point.
Right, yeah, that's a great point. Fernando, you want to bring us in on this next composer?
Our next composer is number 86, Benjamin Godard, a French composer who lived from 1849 to 1895. He was a French composer and violinist, actually, known for his orchestral output. He has five symphonies and two piano concerti. A big critic against the music of Wagner, this is reflected in his own music. Symphonie Gothique is a great work that evokes images of Gothic architecture, and so much of Godard's work is very, very reminiscent of some earlier periods of music.
It's funny, we were just talking about the relationship between Baroque music and classical music, as well as Romantic music. So really, really great example with Godard here. This is one that Fernando introduced me to that has really struck my interest, and Symphonie Gothique in particular is one you should check out. Next, we have number 98 on our list, Vasily Kalinnikov. He is a Russian composer, born in 1870 and passed away in 1901. He is a Russian composer of two symphonies and several other orchestral works. Most performed is likely his first symphony. There's a great wind band transcription, actually, of the finale, which was my exposure to Kalinnikov's music. Kalinnikov, unfortunately, passed away much earlier in life from tuberculosis. His works became more popular posthumously, piquing the interest of Sergei Rachmaninoff as well as Tchaikovsky in particular. So you know that your music is pretty good when you attract the attention of greats like that. So certainly Kalinnikov's music has had a legacy well beyond the scope of his limited time on this earth.
That's right, and we've got another one with quite a legacy. Who's next, Alex?
Brahms, number 96 on our list. He is a German Romantic composer. In the late 19th century, the phrase entitled the Three B's was coined, with Brahms taking his place next to Beethoven and J.S. Bach. To us, this might be a little bit extreme, but the comparisons to J.S. Bach and Beethoven are certainly accurate. And what I mean by that is that Brahms does not rank nearly as high as J.S. Bach and Beethoven on our list. I feel that those composers outshine Brahms in almost every way personally, but that's us personally. We still think that he deserves a spot on this list for sure. It feels as if his symphonies follow in that lineage of symphonic tradition of Beethoven in particular, I would say. That comparison just warrants further analysis, because it's music that, if it is compared to the music of Beethoven, then certainly worth checking out. We actually have some listening for you today. We have his Hungarian Dance Number 1. These are Fernando and I's favorite music from Johannes Brahms, and I think you guys will really enjoy. This is his first Hungarian dance. Let's take a listen. Was Johannes Brahms' Hungarian Dance Number 1. What a fantastic example of romantic style, and one of my favorites from Brahms. So surely check out the rest of his Hungarian dances. Fernando, I think you have some favorites.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of them are really good. 4, 6, of course, the iconic Number 5. There are a lot of great Hungarian dances from Johannes Brahms.
Well, Fernando, you want to bring us into the 20th century here?
Yeah, so we're skipping ahead quite a bit. We're going all the way to the 20th century. That's, of course, the 1900s. And we're going to start with the early part of the 20th century, or at least what I consider to be early 20th century music. We're starting with a pair of composers here. Number 76, Olivier Messiaen, a French composer who lived 1908 to 1992. And number 77, Elliot Carter, an American composer who lived from 1908 to 2012. Both composers, born only one day apart in December of 1908, are best known for their rhythmically, harmonically, and melodically complex works. Ranging from chamber music to orchestral music, their music is extremely challenging for every musician that performs or even studies it. While Messiaen's earlier works were influenced by serialism and parameterization, Messiaen's later unique harmonic and melodic language stems from his modes of limited transposition. For Messiaen, these were 7 different scales based on symmetry and intervallic repetition. 2 examples include the whole tone and octatonic scales, which you might be familiar with. Both scales are symmetrical and have a repeated interval pattern. For the whole tone scale, it is whole steps. For the octatonic, it is a pattern of 1/2 step followed by a whole step. Messiaen was also fascinated with birdsong and traditional Japanese music. The influence of birdsong can be seen in works such as Le Mer Noir and Usos Exotiques. while the influence of Japanese music can be seen in his Sept Haikai.
Meanwhile, Carter's early works are more neoclassical in nature, with influences from Stravinsky, Copland, and Hindemith. Carter never adopted serialism, but rather he independently developed and cataloged all possible collections of pitches in his Harmony book. These influences from Stravinsky, Copland, and Hindemith are the allure of both of these composers in my eyes. However, it's also due to these influences that they didn't rank as highly for me. I would have since added them to my personal list, but both of these came from Fernando's list, and he exposed me to them. And now I understand more of what new they bring to the table, and because of that, my respect for their music has grown for me over time.
The most unique aspect of Carter's music in particular is the rhythmic layering and metric modulation. His use of polyrhythms and rhythmic layering can be seen as an extension of counterpoint, really, while his metric modulation allowed him to escape the steady beat and demonstrate continuous acceleration and deceleration. Both Messiaen and Carter were trying to advance music in new ways that were appropriate for the new century. Now, our recommendations for Messiaen and Carter. For Messiaen, I would recommend the Tarangalila Symphony. And for Carter, I would recommend Symphony No. 1 if you're a real big neoclassical lover. Or for the ultra-modernist, you could also check out Symphonia and his string quartets.
Yeah, some real taste breakers there. Definitely check those out. Now, our next composer on this list is another one of Fernando's higher-ranking composers.
Right, another one that was around the same time as Messiaen and Carter, but distinctively different. It is John Cage, who was number 95 on this combined list. He was an American composer from 1912 to 1992. Cage pioneered indeterminacy and non-standard use of instruments in music. You might be familiar with his ever-popular 433. While this work inspires a lot of humor between musicians, it also poses an important question. What qualifies as music? Cage was a philosopher in his own right and would explore this question frequently. With influences from his teachers Henry Cowell and Arnold Schoenberg, as well as East and South Asian cultures, you might be able to imagine how unusual this music may sound to listeners of more traditional Western classical music. If you enjoy the avant-garde, Cage might be the composer for you. I would recommend his Imaginary Landscapes numbers 1 through 5. Those are very imaginative and avant-garde works.
Those are some works that we actually put down while we were typing up the notes for this episode, and it just got us in a zone. We were really, really working hard while we were listening to this music, so perhaps it might be some good study music.
Right, perhaps. Who's next on the list, Alex?
So these are two composers that I brought to the table here that weren't on Fernando's list. Number 80, Florence Price, a 20th century African-American composer, and Haydn Wood, a 20th century English composer. Let's talk about Florence Price first. So she lived from 1887 to 1953. Florence Price is significant for being the first African-American female composer to have a symphony performed with a major orchestra, that being the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She went on to write four spectacular symphonies, a mix of romantic style and traditional African-American music. Florence Price's catalogs of works are actually dominated by works for the piano, which I don't hear about as often, but also wrote a number of smaller works for orchestra, voice, and chamber music. I would recommend her first symphony in particular. It really is just such a great and amazing cultural experience on its own, but is fantastic music in its own right, so absolutely worthy of being on this list and checking out. Next, we have Haydn Wood, a 20th century English composer. He's a little bit lesser known in the realm of English composers. He just so happens to share a name with the much more famous Franz Joseph Haydn, that we talked about on last week's list. Purely coincidental, different countries and time periods. He studied at the Royal College of Music prior to Vaughan Williams and Holst. We've talked about that a few times on the show. Haydn Wood grew up on the Isle of Man, however, which influenced a lot of his compositions. In fact, that brings me to my recommendation for you today. My favorite work by Haydn is his Man in Veen. This is Manx Gaelic for Dear Isle of Man. This work is a cornerstone of the windband repertoire and is a must-listen for lovers of English music. It certainly stands just as well beside the English Folk Song Suite by Vaughan Williams and the Suites for Band by Gustav Holst. Definitely take a listen there.
Florence Price and Haydn Wood will definitely be two composers I'll be checking out this week. But we've got a lot more to cover, so let's move on to the middle 20th century, or what we're considering the middle 20th century. We've got a trio to start it off. We have Per Norgård, Peter Menin, and Gottfried von Einem. First up is number 85, Per Norgård. He is a Danish composer who was born in 1932 and is still around today. You might remember him from our Nordic Composers episode. If you haven't listened to that episode, Norgård is an incredibly imaginative and scientific modernist composer. He developed one of his primary forms of composition from the serialist Infinity series. This is how he serializes melody, harmony, and rhythmic content in his music. It's not necessarily atonal music or minimalist, but his music contains some of these aspects. Norgård is very interested in Eastern philosophy. One of his operas was even written about Siddhartha. The expansion of consciousness while fully conscious, the title of one of his articles, is a good indicator of a lot of his music. Our recommendations are his 8 symphonies, particularly Symphony No. 1, Symphonia Austera.
Yeah, that's another one that we've been checking out just recently, and I've watched some great videos of Norgård actually speaking about his music, and he is very, very introspective and just a really, really creative composer. Certainly one worth checking out. Next on our list, we have Peter Menin, who is a 20th century American composer, ranked number 94 on our combined list. He was born in 1923, passed away in 1983. Now, he's a bit of an underrated American orchestral composer. In fact, there's not very many recordings of his great 9 symphonies and various smaller scale symphonic works. Menin is actually an Italian immigrant, with the Americanized Menin coming from Menini. So that was an interesting fact that I hadn't realized before. This actually blends into his orchestral writing and gives it an international sound that further bolsters its appeal to us. The 3rd symphony, actually described by Henry Cowell, who we'll hear about a little bit later, is quoted as a delicately original work, musical, feelingful, performable, and enjoyable. And that's describing Peter Menin's 3rd symphony, and one that we will certainly recommend to our listeners. The work begins with a robust yet lilting and dance-like opening that feels right at home with the symphonies of von Einem, which we'll talk about next, and Norgård that we just talked about. Speaking of which, you want to bring us in with our next composer, Fernando?
Number 78, who's in this trio with Norgård and Menin, is Gottfried von Einem. He was a 20th century Austrian composer from 1918 to 1996.
He primarily was an opera composer influenced by Stravinsky and Prokofiev.
Not bad influences, if you ask me. The neoclassical influences throughout his works is combined with jazz to make a truly unique musical voice. My recommendation for von Einem is the Philadelphia Symphony. The 3rd movement in particular is very groovy but complex. And if you're interested in opera, check out Das Stundenlied, one of his most significant operas.
Yeah, definitely one of the composers that Fernando introduced me to that I've certainly dove into the most. Very, very reminiscent of a lot of romantic sounds, as well as the music of Stravinsky and Prokofiev. So very appealing to me. Next, we have a bit of a pair here. This is a lot different than this previous pair that we went over. So in the scope of 20th century music, we have composers like von Einem and Peter Menin and Per Norgård that are composing at the same time as this way different pair of Milton Babbitt and Pierre Boulez. Fernando, take it away.
Well, let's start with Milton Babbitt, who ranked 90 on our combined list. He was a 20th century American composer from 1916 to 2011, and he was nearly infamous for his complex music and extremely academic writing. He was a proponent of total serialism, control over every aspect of the music, and of electronic music. Babbitt wanted to control all aspects of his compositions, and synthesizers allowed him to do so. And so if you're interested in that, if that piques your interest, make sure to check out his composition for synthesizer. Now, his interest in electronic music parallels with Pierre Boulez. Pierre Boulez, who ranked number 88, was a French composer and conductor from 1925 to 2016. He was a student of Messiaen, who we just mentioned before. Thus, Boulez also had a strong interest in the avant-garde and complex side of music, particularly integral serialism and controlled chance music.
Boulez, like Babbitt before, became another advocate for electronic and electroacoustic music with his own compositions. He also had a very successful career as a conductor, typically programming 20th century works by his predecessors and contemporaries.
Our recommendation for Boulez would be Le Marteau sans Maître. It's a fantastic modern work that is very complex and might be a little bit hard on some people's ears, but I find it incredibly enjoyable. The main thing about these complex compositions, after a few listens, you can really find the groove within the academic complexity.
Oh, I'm right there with you. As soon as I opened my eyes to how groovy and how catchy some of these seemingly atonal and unlistenable lines in this kind of music could be, I just felt enlightened. I just been opened up to this whole new genre of music. Speaking of which, as we move later into the 20th century here, we got a whole nother style of music. We have this pair of Philip Glass and Steve Reich, who we're going to call our minimalists for today's list. And it's funny because Philip Glass himself actually doesn't like being called a minimalist.
That's right. And I think if you listen to some of Glass's music, particularly his symphonies, you'll find that it's not exactly minimalist in a lot of ways. But the point of minimalism is kind of a counter movement to the complexity that we just talked about with Babbitt and Boulez.
It's interesting how reactionary 20th century music can seem from the outsider in that way. Let's go ahead and get into this. So number 92 on our list is Philip Glass, an American composer born in 1937. There really is nothing super minimalist about the output of Philip Glass. Maybe surface level, but he has an extensive catalog ranging from operas to solo piano works. Even of his style, Glass prefers to say that it's music with repetitive structures rather than minimalism. So there are some repetitive structures and there are some repeated lines in there, but if you dive past that surface level, you'll discover some of the complexity not only in the orchestration, but the voicing of melodies, and there's just a lot to get into with Glass.
Like I said before, the repetition that Glass uses allows for him to explore a style that starkly contrasts the works of composers that we just mentioned, being Babbitt and Boulez. Now, some recommendations here, some that we've really gotten into in researching for this episode, Glass works and Philip Glass's 12 symphonies. We've been listening to a lot of the symphonies recently, and we went through Glass works while writing some of the notes. And it really puts you into this trance-like state sometimes. But also, you can find the groove, just like with the complex music, you can find the groove of this music and really start to feel it internally, even passively, if you're listening to it passively.
And I think that's part of the goal of Glass's music, as well as this next composer that we'll discuss here, is that music is such an internal experience in that way, even if you're not listening intelligently, you're just listening passively, and it can affect you in that way without you even knowing it until you stop to think about it. Fernando, bring us in with this next composer.
All right, our next one is 97, Steve Reich. He is an American composer born in 1936, and he was another proponent of repetitive music. However, Reich frequently accomplished these repetitions with tape loops rather than more live performance of repetitions. He has even used recordings of speech in works like It's Gonna Rain and City Life. Some people might not be familiar with Reich's music based on historical themes and his Jewish heritage. One example is his work, Different Trains. And our recommendation for Steve Reich, for the minimalist lovers, Music for 18 Musicians is a great example of minimalism. And for the historically inclined, the previously mentioned Different Trains is another great example. If you're interested in getting into the more historical and Jewish heritage-based works by Steve Reich. And before we move on, I wanted to mention the technicality and the challenge of performing these types of works by Reich and by Glass, and that's why I think they work so well in a pair. It's similar music, with the music being repetitive, but that repetition makes it so much more challenging. Imagine having to play the same measure 100 times or more over and over again, and that could happen in one of these works. And for Glass, you're doing it live a lot of the times. And for Reich, you have to get the first recording perfect in order for it to be looped and work with the rest of the work.
And it's music that can't be taken with a grain of salt in that way. You've got to respect the tenacity of these performers and the sheer ability and endurance that it takes to play this music. Let's go ahead and move on to another contrasting pair here, completely different from Reich and Glass. This is a pair of Martin Mailman and Arturo Marquez. We'll start with Martin Mailman, who is a 20th century American composer born in 1932, passed away in the year 2000. Mailman is known for his orchestral and wind band output. We prefer him for his wind band catalog, but his orchestral works are also unique and shouldn't be ignored. A unique composition by Mailman is Four Precious Friends Hid in Death's Dateless Night for wind band. This is actually taken from Shakespeare's Sonnet 30 and shows off the introspective side of Mailman's collection of works. That was really exciting for me as someone who really likes to relate that literary side of me to music. That was really, really exciting. And also why I think this pair of Martin Mailman and Arturo Marquez works so well. Arturo Marquez is a 20th century Mexican composer, so same continent. Marquez is known for his interdisciplinary crossover of works as well, more in the realms of theater and dance and cinema and photography, which brought him on a quest for new kinds of sound. It's so interesting to me that he turned to those styles, those genres of performing arts in search of new sounds, and I think that's something we can all learn from. He's most known for his danzons, a style of Cuban and Mexican dance that brought new life in his orchestral versions of the style. His danzon number 2 for orchestra, and for me as well, the popular wind band transcription, is our recommendation for Marquez. This piece can be quite exciting, yet contemporary in composition and orchestration. Definitely one to check out. Really, really popular work over the last couple years.
Certainly. So we're moving on to another Hispanic composer, this time an Argentinian. Number 89, Astor Piazzolla. He was a 20th century composer from 1921 to 1992. Piazzolla was famous for his work in the realm of the tango. He took great interest in classical, Latin, and jazz styles, which led his music to achieve a worldwide appeal and appreciation. His composing career in the realm of the orchestra, as well as his more commercial tango offerings, has left a great mark in the world of music.
Perhaps his most well-known work and album title is his Liber Tango. Liber Tango has had several famous orchestral performances and arrangements as well, which is what led both of us to Piazzolla's works. Yo-Yo Ma in 1997 on his album Soul of the Tango, the music of Astor Piazzolla. That was an arrangement that I just recently came upon and really, really enjoyed. But the one that really brought me in was Alison Balsam, who's a famous trumpet player, performed an arrangement with orchestra at the BBC Proms in 2009, which is a video I think I have watched about 1,000 times on YouTube. I cannot get enough of that arrangement and that performance, which helped lead me to the world of Astor Piazzolla and his music.
So that brought us all the way up to kind of the end of the 20th century here, going all the way from early to late 20th century music. And so now we're going to backtrack a little bit, going back all the way to the period of time that I call the turn of the century period in music. And I define this period separately from the Romantic and 20th century styles for a particular reason. Beginning with Mahler, music began to explore new avenues. Each composer has their own take on music that begins to stray away from Romantic period's values and ideals and explore something new. It is a connective period from the Romantic period to the 20th century, but it is also distinct because it introduces various new concepts.
So this brings us into the early turn of the century, and this is an interesting period of time because the textbooks don't really go out of their way to define this point of time too much, but I think it's worth noting these composers separately from the Romantic period and even the 20th century in some regards. So the first composer we'll talk about is number 84, Arnold Schoenberg, a 20th century Austrian composer. Early, though, he was born in 1874 and passed away in 1951, so he kind of exists in this weird bubble that we call the early turn of the century. He is the pioneer of what we call the Second Viennese School. We've talked about his contemporaries before on the show, in fact. This school is referred to in contrast of the great classical First Viennese School, which includes Mozart, early Beethoven, Haydn, etc. In contrast, the second, which is categorized by its evolved understanding of romantic harmonies, this later evolves into further development of chromaticism and atonality, and then famously into Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone serialism. We would like to show you some serialism today. We'd like to show you one of his more atonal works that's not quite to the serialist level yet. This work is really famous. This is his Piero Lunaire, written 1899. And if you think about the music that's being written in 1899, this one will be quite a shock for you. Let's go ahead and take a listen.
Den Wald in man mit Augen trinkt, gießt noch der Mond in Wogen nieder. Und eine Springflut überschwemmt den stillen Horizont. Gelöste, schauerlich und süß, du schwimmen ohne Zahl die Fluten. Den Wein, den man mit Augen trinkt, gießt nachts der Mond in Wogen nieder. Der Dichter, der die Augen trinkt, berauscht sich und den heiligen
That was Arnold Schoenberg's Piero Lunaire from 1899. Atonal, but not quite serialist yet for Schoenberg. He would get much more advanced in his 12-tone serialism later.
But incredibly advanced for 1899. This is crazy.
Right. You don't really think of this type of music, this sound, within the context of the 1800s still, even though it's right on the cusp of 1900.
Right, but Mahler is still writing fairly romantic symphonies at this point.
And he's doing much of his own experimentation as well.
Yes, and at this point, they're contemporaries. Mahler is technically Czech, but they are contemporaries in Vienna and Austria at this point. But you could see this diverging path in music as some composers start to stay on this romantic path, maybe just refining it with a little bit more chromaticism and such. But Schoenberg going for something completely different in 1899.
Another one that's kind of going for something quite different is number 81, Zoltán Kodály. He was a Hungarian composer from 1882 to 1967. He was also a ethnomusicologist. If you like Bartók, you're going to like Kodály. They had very similar hobbies and interests as well as compositions. Kodály is known as a pioneer in the realm of music education, with the Kodály method, that method being prepare, present, and practice as the main ideology. And so we actually have some listening for Kodály as well. His Serenade Opus 12 was premiered at a chamber music festival in Salzburg, Austria, and Paul Hindemith actually played viola in the premiere. Unfortunately, we don't have a recording from the premiere with Hindemith on viola, but we do have a recording, so let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Kodály's Serenade Opus 12, which was premiered at a chamber music festival in Salzburg, and Paul Hindemith played violin at the premiere. Again, a really cool fact there that I thought was really interesting. Just shows the connection between the composers of this time period. Speaking of connection, he had quite the connection with Bartók, like we mentioned previously. They were very, very good friends and often did things together. So you'll notice a lot of similarities between Béla Bartók and Zoltán Kodály's music. Next, we have the middle turn of the century, which we only have one of those composers to talk about today, but this is kind of starting to be a little bit more of that 20th century style, but maybe not quite there yet. So we have Edgar Varèse, number 82. He's a French composer. 1883 to 1965 are his dates. He was born in France, but actually spent the majority of his career in the U.S. We're talking about a lot of composers that spent their careers in the U.S. today. These works of various instrumentations for orchestra and chamber works, not one of them are the same. They're just so different and so varied.
Varèse is perhaps best known for being the pioneer of electronic music, most notably for his Poème électronique and Ionization. And with electronic music, this is kind of the predecessor to Babbitt and Boulez.
Yes.
With some more synthesizer heavy and electroacoustic works, I think Varèse had a strong influence and started really to bring to the forefront electronic music. And that's why he's in this turn of the century period rather than categorizing him as either romantic or 20th century composer. He's the kind of the introduction to the world of electronic music that would lead to the 20th century composers really utilizing electronic music.
Yeah, it's cool to see where it all started with Varèse here. There's just so much to get into with electronic music, and hopefully in season two we can dedicate a whole episode to that. I think that'd be fascinating, and see where it started and where it's gone and such. Next, we have the late turn of the century, which just in terms of harmony and compositional techniques is just starting to get a little bit closer to what we would categorize as being truly 20th century music. Fernando, you want to take it away?
So the first one that we have in the late turn of the century period is number 75, Henry Cowell, and he was an American composer from 1897 to 1965. He was an American music pioneer, in fact, that inspired some of the more well-known avant-garde and experimental composers that came after him. His string piano techniques, involving the pianist plucking the strings inside of the piano, actually led to John Cage's prepared piano works, and his book New Musical Resources, containing a variety of innovations in harmony and rhythm, had a powerful effect on the later avant-garde composers. Conlan Nancarrow said of the book that it had the most influence of anything I've ever read in music. Cowell was yet another composer that was heavily influenced by world music as well. Particularly, for Cowell, music from Indian, Japanese, Chinese, and Irish cultures. That's a whole lot. So our recommendations for Henry Cowell include Ongaku, a piece that is influenced by Japanese culture, his 21 symphonies, his work Polyphonica, and for those interested in prepared piano works, The Banshee.
I know I've been listening to number 16, his Icelandic symphony. Cowell is so fascinating to me in that way because he takes so much from world music. And again, we keep stressing this on the show that this interdisciplinary element of music is among the deepest and most engaging part of music history during this time period, as you're starting to see, as the world becomes more known to more people, that people are borrowing from different parts of the world in their music styles. And it's just so fascinating. And to have a composer of this magnitude be this underrated is honestly criminal. Henry Cowell is just fantastic, and these 21 symphonies, they are no slouches. In fact, they're some of the greatest American symphonies ever written. I'd put them right up against Copland and others.
Yeah, and that is very high praise, but very well-deserved praise for Henry Cowell, one of my favorites. He was on my list, and he, I'm sure, is going to be added to Alex's list.
I was completely unaware of the music of Henry Cowell, and then we were having a discussion about American music, and Fernando brought up Henry Cowell, and I'm like, who? The fact that someone as invested in music as I am had not even heard of Henry Cowell, I was like, oh my gosh, more people just gotta know about this composer and his music. Speaking of great composers, let's go ahead and move on to number 93 on our list. This is a French composer, Francis Poulenc. He was born in 1899, passed away in 1963. French composer and pianist, his works include a lot of songs and solo piano works, as well as chamber music, choral pieces, operas, ballets, and orchestral music. His fairly diatonic and melody-based music, even with its simplicity, Poulenc's music still finds this abject way to affect your mood, and it's really quite fascinating. And we have such a great listening example for you today. This is his trio for oboe, bassoon, and piano, the third movement, the Rondo. Let's take a listen. Poulenc's trio for oboe, bassoon, and piano, movement 3, the Rondo. What a fantastic, starting to really embody some of the ideals of 20th century music. Fantastic work. In fact, I couldn't think of a better way to cap off our listening portion of this episode than this work. We've gotten into more modern works than I ever thought we would be able to get into on this podcast, and it's just been such a dream to talk about this music.
Yeah, and the opportunities that we've had to listen to some more modern works, even though they have been limited, have been wonderful. I've really appreciated that, especially being the lover of more modern music that I am.
It's interesting how many modern composers ended up on today's list. From both of us, I think that the outliers ended up being either modern composers that either of us just didn't listen to as much, and now we love. We've really fallen in love with this list in particular. It's just so much to love about these 27 composers. We're not done yet, though. We still have two composers, and perhaps the most modern and most active and some of the most just current composers that we have. They're both composers of film music. Now, Fernando kind of made it a rule of himself not to put any film composers on the list. I cannot help myself with these two. And if you've seen our film scores episode way back, then you probably have an idea of who those two might be. The first one is obvious. John Williams. He is American film composer, born in 1932, still writing great music today. Really, really fantastic. Incredible legacy of 5 Academy Awards, 50 nominations, and he's won more than 30 Grammy Awards and nominations as well. Just such iconic scores. When you think about the modern American orchestral experience, the composers that probably make the most money for orchestra are Beethoven, Mozart, and John Williams.
Right. I can't imagine a Pops concert without a John Williams score on the program.
Even then, it's become such an event I've seen whenever orchestras are doing screenings of these films like Home Alone or Star Wars, and the orchestra is playing the score along with it. Those got to be the biggest moneymakers, because you're not only attracting the orchestral and the classical music crowd that loves this music, but the armies of fans of these movies that also have grown such an appreciation for this music. So for that reason alone, I think John Williams is worthy of a spot on this list and has entered the classical orchestral music canon. So I broke the rules a little bit there. Now, and this one is a really big composer in Japan and has had increasing popularity around the world. Joe Hisaishi ranked number 79 on our combined list. Japanese composer, his expert use of modes as well as traditional Japanese music theory, which features such a unique combination of scales that don't really appear in Western music, and then the European influences from Beethoven, and then influences from 12-tone serialism. He even talks about in some interviews the importance of composers, these composers, to his process, including Berg, Webern, Schoenberg, and Xenakis. It just all coalesces into such a modern, yet tuneful, and incredible melodic experience that comes from Joe Hisaishi's music. And Fernando and I always find ourselves coming back to his music. In retrospect, if I could include another film composer on this list, and I think Fernando agrees with me, we'd include someone like Michael Kamen, maybe. But I think that Joe Hisaishi, for me, enters my listening too often and in that same vein as Beethoven or Dvorak or Mahler as an orchestral listening experience that I could not include him on this list. So I broke the rules once again, but I'm not going to apologize for loving Joe Hisaishi's music. It's fantastic, truly.
It certainly is fantastic, and I also have a great appreciation for it. If you're unfamiliar with the name, you'll probably be familiar with the film company that he frequently works with, Studio Ghibli.
I didn't even mention that.
Right. And so you'll know films such as Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, and others. So to wrap things up a little bit here, we've finished all of the composers from our top 100 composers lists.
Wow, what a marathon.
Yes, and it's been quite a fantastic series. And it is actually going to conclude season one of the Leading Tone podcast. We want to thank all of you for tuning in, whether it be from the beginning way back in July or a new listener, we truly appreciate the support.
Yeah, I can't second that statement enough. When we began the show amidst the height of this global pandemic, we were both unsure of what would be to come. I think I can speak for the both of us. We never imagined how much support we would have received for this show and could not be more thankful for all of you listeners at home.
We are incredibly excited for the future of the Leading Tone podcast. Season 2 will bring on some exciting changes, both in format as well as content. We'll also be moving our episode release dates to Wednesdays.
Yeah, important there. So if you've been expecting us on Mondays, we will be moving to Wednesdays, but I think you'll be excited about some of the changes that are coming. Until then, if you haven't caught up with our previous shows, we have a lot of great past episodes detailing composers and works that we love that you should be sure to check out.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week on Wednesday. Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.